This is the daily radio ministry of Pastor Sandy Adams of Calvary Chapel Stone Mountain in Atlanta, Georgia. Pastor Sandy is currently teaching through his series on the Sermon on the Mount. Here's Pastor Sandy with his message entitled, Jesus Culture.
Well, in Matthew chapter 5, beginning in verse 1, we read, "And seeing the multitudes, he," or Jesus, "went up on a mountain. And when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when they revile and persecute you and say all kinds of evil against you falsely for my sake. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so they persecuted the prophets who were before you." Not all sermons are created equal. Sermons are like pizzas. They come in different sizes and in different varieties. For one, perhaps you've heard of the rocking chair sermon. It goes back and forth, but it really gets you nowhere. Then there's the casserole sermon. There's a little bit of everything thrown in, but nothing solid to really chew on. And then there's the Battle of Jericho sermon. That's when the pastor marches around the subject 7 times before it falls flat. Then there's the Duracell sermon. You know about this one. It keeps going and going and going. And, of course, the oil rig sermon. If you haven't struck oil in 20 minutes, stop boring. And then finally, there is the Atlanta Braves sermon. It starts out on a good note, but the longer it goes, the worse it gets. Well, the Sermon on the Mount is none of the above. If sermons were pizzas, this one would be a sermon supreme. In this sermon, Jesus lays out his manifesto. He sets out a better way for us to live and for us to interact with one another. For the folks sitting there on the grassy knoll overlooking the Sea of Galilee, those who had first heard this sermon, this was a sermon they would never, ever forget. You see, prior to this sermon, Jesus had been traveling the countryside, preaching that the kingdom of heaven is at hand. Here he explains the nature of his kingdom. Jesus gives his followers a glimpse of what his kingdom looks like. The Sermon on the Mount could be called the Christian Manifesto. This is the very heart of Jesus' message. Matthew 5 begins, "And seeing the multitudes, he went up on a mountain." Whenever we visit Israel, we stop at the traditional site of the Mount of Beatitudes. There on the northwest shore of the Sea of Galilee, there is a knoll overlooking the lake. As the hill slopes toward the water, it wraps around a banana grove, forming an outdoor amphitheater. You can stand on the ridge atop the amphitheater, and you can be heard hundreds of feet away. The acoustics are perfect for a man delivering a sermon to a large crowd. Well, Jesus positioned himself, and we're told that when he was seated, his disciples came to him. Now notice a peculiarity here. Jesus sits down to teach. You know, today the speaker usually stands, but the rabbi in the synagogue would sit down. What he said walking or standing was considered informal, off the record. But when he sat, he was making an official statement. This is why even today when a university's physics department creates a teaching position, they call it the chair of physics. Official announcements and formal teachings are symbolically done from a chair. When a pope makes the proclamation, he does so ex cathedra, or in Latin it means to speak from the chair. It's the same idea. The chair was the place of authority. And so when Jesus sat down to teach, his disciples knew that he was about to make a heavy, heavy statement. Now remember, Jesus came on the scene preaching the kingdom of heaven is at hand. His motive is to bring heaven to earth. You could say in coming to earth, Jesus had gone behind enemy lines. He'd gone behind the kingdoms of men to establish the kingdom of heaven. But what were the values and the priorities of God's kingdom? Well, Jesus answers that question here in this sermon. In fact, Jesus reveals just how diametrically opposed are the priorities of heaven from the traits prized here on earth. And nowhere is this clearer than with these first eight Beatitudes. The values of heaven stand in sharp contrast to the principles applied here on earth. In fact, here's a summary of these first eight Beatitudes. You could sum them up as follows. The world admires haughtiness. Heaven prizes humility. The world loves to laugh. Heaven listens to our mourning. The world is impressed with force. Heaven loves gentleness. The world is into the here and now. Heaven hungers for the spiritual and eternal. The world demands justice. Heaven demonstrates mercy. The world assumes corruption. Heaven expects innocence. The world insists on its own rights. Heaven pursues peace. The world crushes its enemies, whereas heaven loves its enemies. The world we live in, it values pride and good times, and control, and materialism, and strict enforcement, and cunning, and winning, and political correctness. And it's as if Jesus walked right into the store and changed all the price tags. He turned life topsy-turvy. Instead of happy are the haughty, Jesus insists, happy are the humble. It's not the party crowd, but the people who can empathize with sorrow. These are the people with the richest joy. It's not the satisfied, but the seekers. Not the hard-nosed, but the forgivers. Not the fighters, but the peacemakers. Not the popular, but it's the persecuted who walk out of this life with God's joy. You see, on the shoreline that day, our Lord Jesus launched a countercultural revolution, a movement that upset the whole social order. His kingdom would be different. Notice Jesus addresses these eight Beatitudes, in fact, his whole sermon, to his disciples. Verse 1, his disciples came to him. Realize this is a sermon for Christians. The only way to live the life of the kingdom is in relationship with the King. Don't misunderstand the Sermon on the Mount. It's not some New Testament law or a moralistic code of behavior. No, it's the outgrowth of a life that's connected with Jesus. I've heard it put, Jesus isn't saying if you do these things, you'll be saved. Rather, he's saying if you're saved, you'll do these things. The Beatitudes are a believer's birthmark. These attitudes are proof that we're part of his kingdom. Here is how the Jesus people roll. And here's the flavor of it. If you want it summed up, here's the essence of these eight Beatitudes. God is far more interested in what we be than in what we do. Throughout the sermon, attitudes prove to be far more important to God than our actions. What pleases God is not just right conduct, but right character. That's why these are the be attitudes, not the do attitudes. God's kingdom is all about motive and heart. In contrast, the Jewish Pharisees, they emphasized performance. They taught, do, do, do. Whereas Jesus stressed heart and character, he said, be, be, be. The Pharisees said, do, do, do. Jesus said, be, be, be. Frank Sinatra said, do be, do be, do, which has absolutely nothing to do with this morning's Bible study, but I just decided to throw it in. No, what matters to God is not so much what we do as what we be. You see, the Pharisees, they did all the right things, but evil lurked in their hearts. Jesus desires a righteousness that comes from the inside out. You remember Paul was a Pharisee before he became a Christian. After his conversion to Christ, he said of the self-righteous life that he had manufactured, he says, I count it but rubbish. Literally there, dung, manure. In essence, he was saying this emphasis on do, it's just that. It's dung. God knows if you'll be the right person, then you'll do the right thing. Well, verse 2 tells us, then he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, blessed. And oh, how I love this word. It means happy. And here it's in the plural. A literal translation would be happy, happy, happy. Sounds like Phil Robertson. The Greek word translated happiness is more than what we think of when we usually use this term. The Greek writer Homer, he used it to describe the rich man who was so rich that he was immune from the cares of the common folk. How he would pay for groceries or how he would pay his rent never once crossed his mind. Happiness for him was freedom from those worries. You know, people assume that this kind of happiness is the result of what I might acquire, or the acclaim I might receive, or the projects I might accomplish. Not so. Real, lasting happiness is the result of coming at life with the right attitude. Jesus says, adopt a certain mentality, and you'll be free from the worries and the cares that burden other folk. And with the time I have left, I want to comment on each of these beatitudes. We'll do so in rapid-fire succession. First, verse 3. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Ah, the poor in spirit. These are the people who stand in stark contrast to the people who are full of themselves. They realize that their debt to God is far too large to be paid off by their own goodness. They've declared spiritual bankruptcy, and they've thrown themselves on the mercies of God. Author Max Lucado writes, the poor in spirit, their cupboards are bare, their pockets are empty, their options are gone. They have long since stopped demanding justice. They are pleading for mercy. They don't brag. They beg. They ask God to do for them what they can't do without Him. These are the folks who no longer make excuses or justify their indiscretions. They've admitted how far short they've fallen, and they ask for God's mercy. Are you among the poor in spirit? You see, the poor in spirit are the spiritual beggars. They realize that their only hope with God is to humble themselves and plead for His help. They look outside of themselves. And Jesus will bless their humility and their admitted neediness with the kingdom of heaven. Ironically, in the end, the spiritual beggars end up the royal heirs. Jesus promises theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Years ago, I taught a Bible study on Romans chapter 3. I entitled the sermon, What You Won't Find in Heaven. In Romans 3, Paul embarks on a long discussion on the necessity of God's grace. And he concludes that discussion in verse 27. And I'm reading here from the Phillips translation. It says, what happens now to human pride of achievement? There is no more room for it. The whole matter is now on a different plane, believing instead of achieving. In other words, no one barters their religious deeds or their good works for God's blessing. Everything about our relationship with God is based on His grace, not our goodness. This means that in heaven, you won't find anybody strutting around with their peacock feathers all plumed out. No room for pride in heaven. We'll realize that nothing was earned. Don't worry, there'll be no stuck-ups in heaven. No snobs in heaven. No one in heaven holier than thou. Everyone in heaven will realize that they did absolutely nothing to get there. That the work was done by Jesus alone, and all we did was have faith. And since the people who show up in heaven will be the poor in spirit, then the same attitude will show up in them before they get there. The citizens of heaven, Jesus says, even while still living on earth, are the poor in spirit. a famous sculptor. He spent a lifetime studying Jesus. He wanted to sculpt his statue. When the project was finished, he invited a friend to come for a preview. The artist ripped off the canvas. His buddy just stood there, scratching his head in awe of the most beautiful sculpture he'd ever seen. There was Jesus with his arms outstretched, but his face looking down. Well, after a long silence, his friend asked him, he said, "I've got just one question. Why is Jesus' face turned downward?" And that's when the sculptor replied, "Well, when I studied the Son of God, I realized that to see his face, you have to be on your knees." Blessed are the poor in spirit. And then blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. The world we live in advertises itself as one big party. Party hardy, man. It's always party time. Good times, lots of laughs, eat, drink, be merry. Isn't this the recipe for happiness? Jesus says, no. The truly blessed person is the man or the woman who's willing to mourn when need be, who can be moved by another person's sorrows. This is the person who recognizes a time for tears. I mean, when there's sin within and there's sin around, how can our eyes stay dry if we truly grasp the consequences of sin? Once it was a zookeeper's elephant that died. He was sitting under a tree sobbing. A bystander commented, "My, how he loved that elephant." The boss kind of laughed and said, "You got to be kidding. He has the job of digging its grave." See, there are all kinds of reasons in life to mourn. We grieve over pain and loss. We mourn uncaused circumstances. We cry over regrets and failures. 2 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 10 even mentions what it calls godly sorrow and worldly sorrow. Worldly sorrow, that's regret over getting caught. That's remorse that I now have to endure the consequences of my sin. But a godly sorrow, this grieves over the hurt that I've caused God and others. It causes me to desire to turn from my sin. It produces repentance. You see, a life with all jollies and no sorrow would make for such a superficial people. Hey, the happiest folks I know are those who haven't been insulated from hurt, but those who have found God in the midst of their hurt. I've heard it said, in order to realize the worth of the anchor, we need to experience first the stress of the storm. Remember, at the tomb of Lazarus, even Jesus wept. Robert Browning Hamilton, he wrote a wonderful poem that reiterates this point. Listen closely. "I walked a mile with pleasure. She chatted all the way, but left me none the wiser for all she had to say. I walked a mile with sorrow, and never a word said she. But oh, the things I learned from her when sorrow walked with me." You see, the first step in fixing what's broken in this world and what's broken in me is realizing that it's broke. Jesus comforts the person who stops pretending that all is well and mourns over the issues that grieve the Lord. Well, the third beatitude is in verse 5. "Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth." Here's a definition for you. Meekness is strength under restraint. Strength under restraint. It's choosing to hold myself back when it's within my power to act. A meek person remains under control. When it comes to meekness, think of cologne. We once had a guy on the worship team, and he wore this stinky cologne. And he wore it so heavy that as soon as you walked in the doors back there, you could smell it. It was awful. You see, cologne needs to be worn in the right dosage, does it not? If it's too strong, it turns people off. And so it is when a person comes across too forceful. He intimidates rather than invites. The meek person knows just the right dose of how to come across. Once my son Zach, he was playing shortstop on his little league team. A weak hitter who never was on base. He was up to bat. He hit a grounder to Zach. Usually, my son would make the play, but this time, uncharacteristically, Zach airmailed his throw over the head of the first baseman. I was just about to jump on him when all of a sudden Zach winked at me and he whispered, "Dad, I just wanted the kid to get on base so he could feel good for a change." That's meekness. It's not always having to be right or be best. A meek man knows that it's better to win your respect than it is to win the game. That souls are more important than the score. It's the ability to set aside a win for me to achieve a greater godly goal. And God trusts authority to people with this kind of priority. Notice what he says, the meek, they inherit the earth. The Athenian philosopher Pericles, he summed up the world of his day. Fishes in the sea as men do on the land. The great ones eat up the little ones. This is the way of man, is it not? Thankfully, this is not the way of Christ. Psalm 18, verse 35 says of God, "Your gentleness has made me great." You see, his zeal could eat us all up, but he seeks what's best for us, not what's easiest for him. Nowhere is God's meekness more pronounced, more evident than on the cross. There the Almighty kept his emotions, even his power in check, in order to die in our place and reconcile us to God. This is why one day the meek shall inherit the earth. And then verse 6, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." What's your driving passion? What is it that yanks your chain? I mean, life is full of stuff that creates a bloated feeling for a time. I mean, that's why we call it stuff. But it never slakes our deep down thirst. The human experience has been summed up as follows. We are born crying, live complaining, and die disappointed. We learn very early in life that a physical pleasure will never satisfy a spiritual hunger. And thus we're left longing. Realize the words that Jesus uses here, hunger, thirst, these are brutal words. These are strong, intense terms. You see, they don't hit us as hard, for few of us have really been hungry and thirsty. Oh, we work in the yard for a couple hours. We come and say, "Oh, I'm so thirsty." We're thirsty because we haven't had anything to drink in the last hour. But to the impoverished first century readers, who first read these words and heard these words, these people woke up every day not knowing where their next meal would come from. They woke up every day knowing they were going to have to scavenger for food that day. To them, these words, hungry, thirsty, they were a punch in the gut. These were strong words. Jesus was saying that when a man becomes so thirsty that nothing else matters to him but quenching that need, not what it will cost him, not maintaining his pride, not protecting his dignity. But when a thirsty person becomes desperate enough to look to Jesus, then they shall be filled. This was Jesus' promise. He promises satisfaction, fulfillment to those who hunger and thirst for him and what he says is right. I love the old saying, "Jesus is the only permanently interesting thing you will ever find." He never grows old. He never gets stale. His mercies are new every morning. In one of his hymns, Charles Wesley penned, "You, O Lord, are all I want. More than all in you I find." Hey, don't ever mistake the smug, self-satisfied person as happy. He might be masking it on the outside, but inside he's empty. No, real happiness comes from admitting that we're thirsty, that we're hungry, that we're desperate for Jesus Christ.
What does the Bible say about judging others? What if a person does something that's directly opposed to the truths of the Bible? What about vengeance? Is it okay for me to get back at those who have hurt me? These are only a few questions Pastor Sandy will answer as he teaches through Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, a series that drills down deep into the core of what it means to be a follower of Christ. This has been another edition of Sandy Adams Radio with our pastor and teacher, Sandy Adams. He's the senior pastor of Calvary Chapel in Atlanta, Georgia. Now, we're sure that today's message has blessed and encouraged you in your walk with Jesus Christ. Maybe you'd like to review this message again, or perhaps a family member or friend has come to mind today. Log on to sandyadams.org and click on the radio program option in the main menu. There you'll find today's message. All you need to do is remember today's date and log on to sandyadams.org. Or you can give us a call here at the church. Our phone number is 770-736-2828. That's 770-736-2828. Someone is standing by to take your order. Again, just mention today's date, and we'll send you the full-length CD. Next time, Pastor Sandy will continue with this insightful study on the Sermon on the Mount. On behalf of Pastor Sandy and the entire production team, we want to say thank you for tuning in, and may God bless you.